Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is the impact of the U.S. invading Venezuela and kidnapping its president and first lady? How might it affect international law, regional security, and America's reputation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. President Trump has declared he is the peace president and has claimed to have ended eight wars. Now, while this is a dubious claim, he did become the first president to bomb eight different nations in his first year in office. He then started 2026 with an invasion of Venezuela and a kidnapping of its president, Nicolas Maduro, as well as his wife, Celia Flores. They await trial in Brooklyn. The president has declared the U.S. will run the nation and will seize whatever oil it desires. The violation of Venezuelan sovereignty, the colonial approach to these resources, and the precedent this invasion is setting for the U.S. throughout the Western Hemisphere is significant and potentially quite threatening to peace. On today's show, we will explore the legal, political, and security implications of this invasion. And we're going to explore what the future of U.S. relations in the hemisphere, as well as the president's rampant use of the military, means for the immediate future of American policy. Our panel today is Gabor Rona. He is professor of practice at Cardozo Law School and is the author of Is There a Way Out of the Non-International Armed Conflict Detention Dilemma? And State Responsibilities to Respect, Protect, and Fulfill Human Rights Obligations in Cyberspace. He also recently has published Venezuelan Boat Attacks, Utterly Unprecedented and Patently Predictable. Carol Wise, she is Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Dragonomics, How Latin America is Maximizing or Missing Out on China's International Development Strategy, and Conceptualizing China-Latin America Relations in the 21st Century, The Boom, the Bust, and the Aftermath. She published that with Victoria Chanchin. And Jeremy Suri. He's professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs and the Mac Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and his latest book, Civil War by Other Means, America's Long and Unfinished Fight for Democracy. He also hosts the podcast, This is Democracy. Thank you all so much for joining us today and confronting the news of this past week. Gabor Rona, let's start with you. Is this attack legal under international law? And what arguments has the U.S. made to make a case that it's legal?
First, Doug, thank you so much for inviting me to this conversation. The simple answer to the question, or at least the first part of the question, is no, this is not legal. This is patently illegal under international law. But I think the question deserves a little bit more exploration because not all illegalities of international law are created equal. And there's something about this illegality that sets it apart, even from, the brazen illegality of Putin's war in Ukraine and from other atrocities that are state-controlled in a number of conflicts around the world. And that is, first of all, I think it's really important to develop a context. The context that I think is most important here is that after the Second World War, the United States was instrumental. There was no state that was more important than the United States in setting a new direction for international law and international relations. The keystone of that new direction, and directly in response to the atrocity that was the Second World War, was the establishment of the United Nations, and within the United Nations Charter, the establishment of the keystone provision, which is that henceforth it will be unlawful for states to not only use force, but even to threaten to use force in their international relations. The only exceptions would be when force is necessary in self-defense or when the Security Council of the United Nations authorizes the use of force. Most of the rest of kind of our lifetime of experience of violations of this prohibition, and there have been many, involve states that always manage to come up with some kind of rationale why they're doing what they're doing. Putin says, well, it was to prevent genocide in Ukraine. Patently false, but at least he's talking in the terms of the international legal framework. What's different here is that this is a patently illegal action, a violation of that very provision of the UN Charter that I was just talking about. And the United States has made absolutely no effort to frame their conduct within the concepts and the rules of international law that the US was so instrumental in helping to develop after the Second World War. So it's not only that this is illegal, but that it tears away at the fabric of this post-Second World War international legal order that has become a really important part of the extent to which there has been a relative degree of peace. There has been opportunity for human rights to flourish. There have been opportunities for international development to flourish. And now the United States is not merely saying, well, what we did was justified under the law, but what they're actually saying is, we don't care about the law. And that is so much more dangerous and harmful than a mere violation alone.
Absolutely. And it kind of reminds me of Stephen Miller's comments a couple of days ago, basically asserting we've got the power and nobody's going to stop us. The implications, I think, are pretty dramatic. And speaking of implications, Carol Wise, the implications in South America for security, specifically security, because Venezuela has posed a security risk throughout the region for a number of years with a significant number of refugees, has the U.S. invasion and the seizing of Maduro, does that offer any hope to ease any of the security risks, or is it just making it all the more insecure?
Yes, it's going to have security risks in the region. In the last year and a half, I've been to Argentina, Peru, Chile, Mexico, and there are so many Venezuelans in the Southern Cone working successfully in all different, capacities. And the region, when they first began this 10 years ago, 11 years ago, this mass out migration, when Maduro was invoking famines and electricity blackouts and just really chaos. So I would say that the neighbors in the region, especially Brazil, have been very warm to Venezuelans. They've been very kind. And Venezuelans, despite the brain drain, are pretty educated. So it's not been seamless. However, it's been fairly successful. That's the last round of out migration from Venezuela. This round, it's going to happen, and I don't think they're going to be as warmly received because they've already absorbed 8 million people, and these countries have their own people to take care of. So yes, it's a security risk, it just in terms of human security. But the flip side of this is quintessentially weak institutions like the Organization of American States are meeting, are, let's say, trying to develop a coalitional strategy to confront this as a region. Latin America is not known for very good relationships with each other. There's wars that go back, just after independence in the 1820s. There's all kinds of strife over borders and whatnot. However, when there's an external threat like this, and the region hasn't faced an external threat like this for a very long time, I'm trying to think. I mean, we have our gunboat diplomacy and all of that, but I would say the 80s with the Contras and whatnot was the last really big external threat. Now, this is a daunting threat because on Air Force One, right after the bombing, the President Trump made comments that are shocking. They're shocking. Who's running Venezuela? Quote me. What are your plans? Well, Mexico looks good. Cuba, well, they're going to fall. Colombia looks good. And this is outrageous. It's absolutely outrageous. Right now, the region is just trying trying very hard to stand together. Though right-wing countries applauding Trump, but there's a bigger coalition of countries that are saying we could be next, and we've got to prepare for this.
And I want to kind of return back and ask what this means regionally for some of the more right-wing governments to have to try to defend this. But I want to bring Jeremy Suri into the conversation as well, since we're talking about the legality question, and Carol raised the question about whether there's any sort of opposition. There is something called the War Powers Act. How does this attack fit with the historic precedents of the War Powers Act, and is it consistent, at all with war-making capabilities constitutionally?
Well, it's an important question, Doug. So at least since the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was, of course, about Cuba as well, presidents, and one could go back earlier to Eisenhower and Guatemala and Iran, presidents of the United States have acted with extreme force in foreign countries, and they have essentially told Congress after the fact. The War Powers Resolution of 1973 was designed to constrain presidents, but it's never really worked. In that way, almost every president has violated the spirit, if not the letter, of the War Powers Resolution. But there is operative legislation that, at the very least, allows Congress to force presidents to leave a conflict. And so, what the Senate has begun to do is actually pursue this. And the resolution written by Tim Kaine, that in a preliminary way passed the Senate with five Republican votes, very specifically refers to the funding packages for the State Department and other elements of the U.S. government. And under the legislation there, basically makes any further contingent spending dependent upon the termination of all activities. All armed forces activities in Venezuela. That is likely to pass the Senate. It might pass the House. Of course, then the president could veto that. Under the War Powers Resolution, there's not really much Congress can do except actually cut off the funding for force. But there isn't any American force on the ground in Venezuela. There is a huge American flotilla, one of the largest we've ever assembled in the Caribbean. Congress could cut off funding for that, but this is the essential problem of our constitutional system that presidents have exploited, none more than Trump, but Trump is certainly not the first, a system that allows presidents to act first and then rely on Congress to defund its operations, which, as you know, is hard to do. Do we want to defund our sailors who are at sea, who are simply following orders right now? That's the challenge we're in. But this is significant, Doug. It's very rare for Congress to express its opposition to the military actions that the president is taking. The last time we've seen this was in 1982, I believe, with the Boland Amendment, which was then violated by Ronald Reagan, but was an amendment that Congress passed that required Reagan to remove funding from the Contras in Nicaragua. It's been a long time since Congress has taken such a strong move. So that is significant, and your listeners should be watching for that.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle. ScholarCircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the U.S. invasion of Venezuela, the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro, the legality, the politics, the insecurity as a result of it. Our guests are Gabor Rona. He is of the Cardozo Law School, Carol Wise of the University of Southern California, and Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas at Austin. And Gabor, you had a response to Jeremy's comments.
I think there's a very important parallel between the domestic law issues that Jeremy was talking about and the international law issues. And I want to make that point. When we all heard that Vladimir Putin said that his invasion of Ukraine cannot be called a war, you must call it a special military operation. And if you call it war, you will be arrested and put in prison. And I think on this side of the Atlantic, we all kind of shrugged our shoulders about that, except to say, well, what do you expect from a dictator? The United States' position now is that, well, we haven't really invaded Venezuela. We haven't started a war. What we've conducted is a police operation in order to effectuate an arrest pursuant to an indictment, of a suspected drug dealer. The connection between the domestic issue and the international law issue, though, is this. Whether the administration wants to call it a special military action or the enforcement of an arrest warrant doesn't matter. What matters is facts on the ground. The facts on the ground are that we invaded another sovereign country, and we didn't do it for reasons of self-defense, and we didn't do it with the say-so of the UN Security Council. And that makes it not only a violation of international law, but it makes it an armed conflict. And once the international laws of armed conflict are triggered, it generates the application of a whole panoply of consequences, including the application of the Geneva Conventions. Who can you kill? Who can you not kill? Protection for civilians, prisoner of war status for combatants. All of these things are triggered because there was a use of force by state A against state B. And just as international law is absolutely clear that this is an invasion, this is an armed conflict, domestic law has to respond just as clearly that if Congress has a role in connection with starting wars, then this is certainly an occasion on which they have to fulfill that obligation.
Yeah, that's a great point, Jeremy. I want to ask you then, Gabor, raises this question about the use of force in this police action. An obvious comparison here was the U.S. Attack and seizure of Manuel Noriega in Panama under the elder President Bush. I do want to return to whether or not that was an act of war and a violation of international law, but from a war powers perspective, first of all, is that a pretty apt precedent in this case? Are there significant differences between the seizing of Manuel Noriega and the seizing of Nicolas Maduro?
So it's a great question to ask, and I think it will come up quite a lot in the next few weeks. It's controversial whether the seizure of Noriega was legal or not. The courts ruled that, in fact, George H.W. Bush acted legally, but many legal scholars, I'm guessing Gabor among them, differ on that view. And so it's an open question still, but within court precedent, the Trump administration will try to claim that precedent. But there are differences here. Whether the differences make this even more legal or not, I don't know, but the differences are significant. The most important one is Manuel Noriega, when we seized him, was not president. He was no longer the sovereign leader of Panama. Now, we might claim that Maduro was illegitimate because he stole an election, but nonetheless, if he showed up at the United Nations before he was kidnapped, he would have been recognized as the leader of Venezuela. He was perhaps illegitimately elected, but nonetheless the sovereign representative of Venezuela. That was not the case with Noriega. And we ourselves make special provision to say that a sitting president, a sitting leader, cannot be subjected to criminal indictment while sitting. So this would seem to matter quite a bit here. In addition, in Panama, there were already hostilities. American forces on the ground that were there for drug interdiction legally, they could claim that they had been fired upon and that this was self-defense. Whether that claim was legitimate or not is debatable, but at least they had a claim. No American forces were being fired on by anyone in Venezuela. Venezuela posed no threat to no American forces when we moved in there. So that seems to be a very large difference as well. And then the third issue is actually, I think, one that's really important here. The Bush administration had a clear policy of indicting and prosecuting those who were drug dealers. And so there was some consistency here. Noriega was, in fact, doing that. The Trump administration has pardoned, for example, the president of Honduras, who was convicted in American courts of being a drug dealer in the United States. So it's very hard to argue that this is a consistent U.S. policy, which then raises the legal question as to what other basis there would be for making this arrest. So I think on all those grounds, this is very different from Panama, but I am quite certain the Trump administration will invoke that precedent in court.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Carol Weiss, I mean, one of the arguments that the administration could have made is, again, most observers think Maduro probably stole that election. It was not a legitimate election. But the refusal to install Maria Corina Machado, who had won that election, really seems to undermine that argument. So I take it. I mean, my own perspective, I don't think this is really about democracy at all. Is that a fair assessment?
No, it's not about democracy at all. And we've all been scrolling through the different feeds on, the situation. And there was some anonymous opposition politician in Venezuela, who said, Trump is jealous of Machado's peace prize. And I don't know if you saw the clip on the news where she even offered to give it to him if she could be recognized as the heir apparent politically. And he's done nothing but diss her and undermine her and make disparaging comments. So, no, listen, the difficult thing here is that all these things that we're saying, the War Powers Act, the United Nations, that the legal framework for international political behavior, if you will. I mean, the difficult thing is most of these people, you think Steve Miller knows about any of this? Do you think he cares? I mean, most of these people making these vital decisions are really pretty low level in many ways, low functioning. And so it isn't like they've done a deep study and they came to this conclusion. It's just that it seems to be that now we have a $1 billion defense budget and this ridiculous Secretary of War wants to spend it. And so we've got the flotilla in the Caribbean. We've got, the invasion with bombing Tehran, now this. We bombed a few other things I can't recall right now, but maybe Yemen. But it's just I can't emphasize too much. It's just impulsive. It's random. The narrative changes. Rubio says that that the government, not him, the government's in charge of Venezuela. Then Hegseth says that Rubio's in charge. And then Trump says he's in charge. And the fact is, they don't know what they're doing. And in this process of acting randomly and foolishly and, rashly, they are doing irreversible damage, not just to international law, but to the Western Hemisphere. It's going to be hard to come back from this, quite frankly. And there's a lot of talking heads like, oh, this is going to hurt China. Wrong. I mean, China is thriving in Latin America and just looks better all the time, given this behavior.
And we're going to circle back to that, but Gabor, before we take a break, I do want to ask, I mean, my understanding of international law is the narratives matter, maybe the courts matter, but what really matters is national action. That concept of opinio iuris is what's legal and what's not legal is, how states are reacting. And when I think about that with the US, couple of the arguments, it's about democracy, but they won't install the person who ostensibly won the Democratic election. It's about drugs, but as Jeremy pointed out, there's the hardening of other leaders and the fact that this it's questionable exactly how closely tied Maduro was to drug running, et cetera. So my question is this: from a legal perspective, it seems like the only real interest the US has is oil. And if that's the case, what does that mean legally, in particular, because it seems awfully colonial to me. And I thought if there's anything that we established legally was that colonialism isn't something we support.
So, if the rationale is oil, then it is patently illegal. Even before there was a UN charter, there were prohibitions dating back from the early 20th century about going to war in order to despoil another country. The idea that the United States has the right to invade the sovereign space of another country in order to enrich itself from the resources of that country is a total throwback to colonialism. But I'm gonna go out on a limb here, Doug, and question whether this is in fact about oil. I'm gonna question whether it's in fact about anything. And what I'm speculating is that in spite of the talk in the new Trump national security strategy about kind of recalibrating our focus from global affairs to regional affairs, in spite of, Trump announcing the Donroe Doctrine, that we are now going to just focus on our own, not only focus on our own hemisphere, but basically dominate our hemisphere regardless of law. I'm not even convinced that they're serious about that. Within the same breath that the national security strategy comes up with this kind of rejiggered Monroe Doctrine, Trump is out there saying, well, if the Iranians continue to, kill protesters, we're going to go back in there and take care of them. So, he can say these like two completely opposing things before breakfast. And so I'm just not convinced that there is any consistent doctrine or theory behind what's going on, other than, this is what the people in power want to do in order to exercise power and to show us all that they can do so. I think maybe it remains to be seen whether we can attribute, any rational, even though illegal, motive to this. Things will play out over the course of time. We'll see what happens as far as oil is concerned, even if it might take a decade or more. But I think from where we sit now, based on the experience we've had so far with the Trump administration, I'm finding it hard to be convinced that there's any theory, that there's any rationale, that there's any doctrine that concerns the interests of the United States. Rather, what I'm seeing is it concerns the posturing interests of a small number of people who unfortunately have happened to have gained the levers of power in the United States.
Jeremy, you had a quick response to that as well.
Yeah, I want to follow on Gabor because I think he's onto something very important here. So if you talk to oil executives, one of the, I guess, advantages of living in Texas is that we have a lot of oil executives here. When you talk to these individuals, they are not enthusiastic about this at all. And they were not consulted. There was no oil company cabal with the president to go into Venezuela for a few obvious reasons. There's too much oil on the market now already. The price is going down. The oil wildcatters in Midland and elsewhere, who are some of Trump's strongest supporters, they're going out of business because oil's going below $60 a barrel. Secondly, they're laying people off. Chevron, Exxon, ConocoPhillips are laying off about 14,000 people to cut costs. They don't have billions and billions of dollars available that their stockholders will allow them to throw into Venezuela. So this is not really about oil. I think Gabor is right. This is really about a president who, as Gabor said, I think pursues a very personalist policy. He's a Chavista himself. I mean, this is the American Hugo Chavez pursuing what's going to be good for him and his small junta, which he thinks, he's deluded to think that's in the interests of the United States. And the other thing that's really striking to me is he's sort of stuck in the 1970s. Everything he does is a 1970s world. This is the way you would have thought about oil during the oil crisis, the repeated oil crises of the 70s. It's the way you'd think about real estate from the 70s, the way you'd think about crime in cities from the 1970s. He's stuck in that moment, and he's ruling as part of a junta right now. And that junta is pursuing its interests. That's really what's driving this. This is not oil industry pushing for Venezuela.
We're going to pursue that if he is a Chavista himself, because I've got some thoughts on that. But I want to give Carol a chance to respond before we take a break.
Yeah, there's no theory or doctrine. I mean, it's just seat of the pants. The other side of oil, and I'm glad you raised this, Jeremy. Yes, the U.S. has been oil independent for over a decade, right? Because of fracking and shale and all of that. And there's really no need. No, okay, let's stop. Sidebar. I mean, the president is doing everything he can to get rid of sustainable energy policies, no electric vehicle encouragement. No green, nothing. Okay, dropping out of the climate treaty again, and this sort of thing. But Venezuelan oil itself has been just run into the ground. It began with Chavez. He fired all the petroleum engineers. PDVSA, which is the Venezuelan state oil company, was a blue chip company. It was a world-class oil major, and it has just been gutted. And production is down by more than half over the last couple of years, on and on and on. So it's not that that is if you really want oil, you should probably go over to not Russia, right? But the stands, Tajikistan. I mean, if you want oil, that's where it is.
Guyana now. Guyana also, Carol. Guyana has
Where?
oil. Guyana.
Yes, that's right. But it isn't about oil. You're right. And he lied. He always lies. I always talk to the majors, the oil company CEOs before I did this. Wrong, right? So no, it again, it is really difficult to watch. It is a meltdown driven by psychological delusions. And I just really hope there still are some checks and balances in the US system, in the US government. They're going to have to try, they're going to have to really assert. Congress is going to have to, get up and going. But this is really, I'm telling you, it's going out of control. It's spinning out of control. Greenland, really, right? And you notice how this distracts from Jeffrey Epstein. And then Greenland distracts from Venezuela, and who knows what's next on their agenda, Canada. So, I mean, I see also just this kind of random moving on to the next thing before you've even explained why you did the last thing. And I might be wrong, I might be too optimistic, but I think this has got to be a critical juncture of revealing what kind of trouble we are in as a people and a nation. It's disheartening, but we still have the checks and balances, and we have got to use them.
When we come back, will the U.S. invasion of Venezuela prompt Latin American leaders to embrace China as an alternative partner in the region? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How might the Monroe Doctrine be impacting the invasion of Venezuela? What does the current U.S. interpretation of the Donroe Doctrine mean for international law and security? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're talking about the U.S. invasion of Venezuela, the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro, what this means for the international legal structure, what it means for the oil markets, what it means for Latin America. Our guests today are Gabor Rona. He is professor of the practice at Cardozo Law School. Carol Wise, she is professor of political science and international relations at the University of Southern California. And Jeremy Suri, he's professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs and the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Jeremy, you're our historian. There's numerous references to the Monroe Doctrine. First of all, what is the Monroe Doctrine, and what does Donald Trump mean when he talks about the Donroe Doctrine?
Right. So the Monroe Doctrine was written by Secretary of State John Quincy Adams for President Monroe. It was put into Monroe's annual address to Congress. And the Monroe Doctrine basically said at a time in the 1820s when countries in Latin America were breaking free of Spanish and to some extent Portuguese authority, it basically said that the United States would not recognize as legitimate any colonial power coming into the region to replace a prior colonial power. Adams was particularly worried. Monroe was worried about the British stepping in and the British establishing an empire in place of the Spanish Empire that was decaying. But the Monroe Doctrine never said anything about American military intervention for a very obvious reason. The United States did not have the military capabilities to intervene in Latin America at that time, nor really in the Caribbean, for that matter. And so this Monroe Doctrine was simply a statement of principle. And John Quincy Adams, being the clever diplomat that he was, recognized that the British would like the idea of there being a doctrine which said the United States would not be coming in if they didn't go in, because the British wanted to create an empire of free trade, an empire where they could benefit from the products of Latin America without having to pay the costs of occupation, which is pretty much what the British did. So the Monroe Doctrine is a statement of American principle. Theodore Roosevelt, in his infamous Roosevelt Corollary in the early 20th century, then says that now the United States will put force behind the Monroe Doctrine in the Caribbean, not in Latin America, not south of the Caribbean, in the Caribbean, in places like Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Cuba, and elsewhere, to enforce order in those areas. And it doesn't really work very well for him, nor for Woodrow Wilson. And the United States largely abandons this with Herbert Hoover. One of the few things Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt agreed on was what was called a good neighbor policy, that the United States would do a lot better by working with the nations of the region. What is the Monroe Doctrine? Well, it's a misunderstanding of the Monroe Doctrine, which was about principle. And it is a vast ruination of the Theodore Roosevelt Doctrine, which was bad enough, but at least focused on a very minor area where the United States had capabilities. The idea was we would go into small islands. I remind your listeners, Venezuela is twice the size of Iraq. There was never a policymaker of any kind that I've studied in the United States before Donald Trump who thought that you could send a force into Venezuela, a country of that size, remove a leader, and then run the country from Washington, D.C. with no force on the ground. This is just silliness, but I don't think there's anyone in Washington now who wants to put a force of 200,000 to 300,000 soldiers, which is what we'd need, on the ground there. So what is the Monroe Doctrine? It is a fantasy of a tin pot dictator in Washington telling the rest of the region how to act, and they're somehow following his dictates because, I don't know, he's so threatening. I don't know. There's really not much substance behind it other than that. It's a spectacle, as most of his claims are.
And Gabor, I think there may be something even more threatening to the international legal order here, though, because the UN had rejected this notion of kind of spheres of influence. The one thing I think I disagree with the panel generally on is that there's no theory behind any of this, because it seems like there is a theory, and the theory is a kind of, from an international relations perspective, kind of a crude offensive realism that suggests a sphere of influence, that the U.S. is going to have a free hand to do whatever they want within the Western Hemisphere. Am I off base there? And if so, that really poses a pretty substantial threat to the notion of global collective security.
So, Doug, I would not disagree with you that there is a through line. And I think you're right. The through line is this is our hemisphere. In fact, if you open up the State Department's website, you'll see a big graphic depiction saying exactly that now. They put up a poster saying this is our hemisphere, and emphasizing the word our, meaning not only this is where we are, but rather this belongs to us. So yeah, I think there is that through line, but I'm not going to back away from my belief that it really is chaos, and without a principled goal, you can have a through line concerning what your explanation is for what your powers are, but you still need to have an explanation of why you're exercising those powers. And I think that's what's missing here. I want to even go back way before, and then again, from the international legal perspective, way before Monroe Doctrine, 1648, Peace of Westphalia, we are now going to organize the planet into a system of sovereign states. What that means is that each state leaves every other state alone. Each state is responsible for determining what happens within their own jurisdiction. There will be international law to regulate relations between and among states, but what happens within your territory is your business alone and not anybody else's business. Now, that's been whittled away at a great deal by human rights law, for example, and other aspects of international law. But the concept of state sovereignty remains the organizing principle of politics on Earth. And the Monroe Doctrine didn't change that. The Monroe Doctrine didn't intend to change that. The Monroe Doctrine, as I understand it, and Jeremy certainly knows more about it than I do, but my understanding is that its principal motivation was in keeping with concepts of state sovereignty, and that is keep the Europeans the hell out of these countries, our countries. The Donroe Doctrine, if there is such a thing, is nothing at all like the Monroe Doctrine. The Donroe Doctrine would have us completely toss in the garbage the concepts that were created in 1648 by the Peace of Westphalia, that we live in a system of sovereign states and it is impermissible, improper, and bad for everyone's health if every country can just invade every other country as a matter of will. Whether it's for oil or because you insulted our leader by dancing like him, or anything else. So this is why, or my perspective from the international law lens of why I think and agree with what Carol was saying too about how pernicious and how dangerous this moment is in a way that I think is unprecedented from previous violations of the international legal order, even since World War II, and how this so-called Donroe Doctrine actually differs from Monroe Doctrine in terms of international law.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the U.S. invasion of Venezuela, the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro, the legality, the politics, the insecurity as a result of it. Our guests are Gabor Rona. He is of the Cardozo Law School, Carol Wise of the University of Southern California, and Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas at Austin. Now, by the way, turning to the region, Carol, I want to ask you, I know that a few years ago, we were speaking about how Latin America was shifting a bit to the left, and we're talking about the so-called pink wave. That seems to have been reversed over the course of the last, year or so in elections in Chile and Bolivia, and Brazil's got an upcoming election as well. The question here is about the resistance to the United States. The strongest argument for the right in Latin America is a strong relationship with the United States, but it seems like Donald Trump's making that particularly difficult for Latin American leaders. Is there a possibility then this could really backfire on the US, inspiring Latin American leaders to really try to resist any connections with the US and create a pretty significant opening? I know you do a lot of research in this area for a country like China to have even more influence in the region.
Let's take that nut job down in Argentina, Milei, right? He can't get enough of Trump. He goes to those right-wing CPAC or whatever it is, those conferences. You saw him on the stage with Elon Musk when Elon Musk had the chainsaw, Doge cutting and all of that. Okay, so Milei, again, is in deep doo-doo inflation. He's going to do a big yet another liberal economic shock treatment. It doesn't work out. He needs $20 billion ASAP, as soon as possible. So Secretary of the Treasury Bessent says, fine, we're going to give you $20 billion, but we want to see if you can win the midterm election of your party. So they have the midterm election, and the party wins, mainly because they think that the U.S. is giving them $20 billion. Oh, guess what? MAGA didn't like it. And by the way, the $20 billion was simply to pay the interest on Argentine government bonds held by the big houses on Wall Street, right? Even MAGA got that. And so no $20 billion. So that is not loyalty. That is not diplomacy. That is stupid, right? I mean, Argentina has squandered billions of dollars from, the IMF and whatnot. But let me just say, I was in Peru in November. One year ago, they launched a mega port on the Pacific called Chancay Port, right? And it is run by China's super mega COSCO, which is a shipping, logistics, and construction company. The data right now show, and there's five feeder trains coming in from resource-rich countries like Ecuador, Bolivia, and Chile. The feeder trains are bringing massive materials, and just the year statistics on this port shows that it is, it's equivalent with early years of, say, the Shenzhen port in China, the Shanghai port. These are mega ports, right? So it is fantastically successful. This is China's relationship with Latin America. All right. Let's get the project. Let's do the project. Let's manage the project. Let's get this going. This is true with, the electric grid in Brazil, the electric grid in Chile. So it's all about construction, infrastructure, and public goods, right? It's not free money, but it's, market-based loans, interest rates. But so this is what China has to offer, okay? It's not free money, but it's a lot of, like they're really filling in huge gaps, especially in infrastructure. This is so different from the US. It's so different. The US has been out of big projects forever, right? Ever since the late 70s. And it's all about services and, international law and treaties around service exports to Latin America from the US. But, China has no intention of going in there and doing any of the things that the US has been doing and promises to do more of. So I think that, all these talking heads, clearly they turned to AI when they were called for interviews and they didn't really know anything on the cable news. And so all these ridiculous statistics were being spouted. Oh, Venezuela supplies 80% of Chinese oil. Wrong. It supplies 1%, right? Oh, this, that, and the next thing. Oh, Venezuela has $60 billion debt to China. Wrong. 20 billion. So, I mean, the situation with China is predictable, diplomatic, professional, and rational. And as my colleagues here are saying, this is not. You are my colleague, Doug. You are an IR scholar. You're a diehard IR scholar. I love you. I respect you. But guess what? There's no theory here. I know it's hard to accept, but it is just knee-jerk, seat of the pants. No theory. I'm sorry. Maybe a psychological theory of, delusion.
Yeah, we IR scholars are always guilty of trying to come up with some sort of explanation for what's been going on, because chaos means we can't teach our classes. But Jeremy, I do want to make sure before we end the conversation, sort of where does the U.S. go from here? Because I think we would all agree that there's been a tremendous diplomatic damage done to the United States, the future of its relations in the region, globally. Is this damage irreversible? I ask you in part because so many of my European colleagues said the first time you elected Trump, we figured it was a bizarre feature of a weird electoral system we don't fully understand, but you did it again. Is this damage irreversible?
Well, I think in some ways, yes, but the question is what damage means in this context. We will probably never, if ever, have the same relationship with our European allies that we had before, that I grew up with and all of us grew up with. When I go to Germany, which I do quite often, there's long been a belief that the United States was a brother country to the Federal Republic. And certainly in England, the sense, and it was unthinkable that the United States would go to war with these countries. And now it's possible that a military conflict in Greenland. Europeans are preparing for that. They're trying to deter the American president now. When was the last time Europeans talked about deterring an American president from invading Europe or part of Europe or seizing territory? And certainly in Latin America, the United States has a long history, as Carolyn knows better than anyone, of bullying and invasion and intervention. But even in the worst moments, there was a sense that that was behind us, that we weren't going to replay the coups of Brazil in 64 and Guatemala in 53, et cetera, et cetera. And here we are again. So I think our reputation is damaged. And I think, as Carol was saying, this is a huge advantage for the Chinese, because our argument, I was in Brazil a summer ago making this argument with other scholars, was that even if the Chinese could offer you more money, don't you want to work with a democracy? Well, it's very hard now to make that case to the Brazilians. Why would Lula want to work with us instead of the Chinese under these circumstances? So in your terms, Doug, we've entered a clearly more multipolar world, not multipolar just in terms of power, but now multipolar in terms of soft power, in terms of reputation. And that's going to be very hard to rebuild. Now, I do think after Trump, the world will sigh a long sigh of relief and be very happy. And we're likely to see a spring back. I've written about this in a number of places, especially on U.S. policy at home. And I think that will be greeted around the world. But it won't spring back to where we were before. It won't be as bad as this. But the days of the United States being even grudgingly recognized as a leader of the free world, those days are far behind us now.
Gabor, I'm going to ask you our last question, sort of the same question, but with the international legal framework. Obviously, international law, the legal framework, this notion of, you know, questions about sovereignty, commitment to law have taken a pretty serious hit. Are we entering into an age where these issues are really not going to matter, particularly because everybody keeps asking, I mean, what kind of punishment is the U.S. going to face if they do break international law? Is this exposing the fact that international law is pretty weak and we're entering into a new phase where it's going to become less relevant, or will it bounce back?
Don't know. Really don't know. But if I could analogize to some aspects of the domestic reaction to Trump policies, you know, if the law firms that he attacked had stuck together, then I think they'd be in a better position than they are in now. If the universities that he attacked had stuck together, they would be in a better position than they are now. The problem is he really, the universities and the law firms were in a very difficult spot. It's hard to be able to say, well, they should have just stood up for what was right when the federal government had so much leverage over them in terms of federal grants, in terms of contracts, etc. I think something similar could be said from the international perspective. And the single most important aspect of the U.S. leverage, as far as Europe is concerned, is Ukraine. Europe is deathly afraid that if the United States pulls the plug on support for Ukraine, that Russia will have a fairly easy time of filling that vacuum and realizing a very significant threat to the security of European states. So Europe's reaction to this adventure on the part of the United States, I think, is muted by virtue of the fear that Europeans have that if they piss off this president too much, he's going to pull the plug on support for Ukraine. If, on the other hand, Europe was able to stick together, and even though within the confines of the EU, they're supposed to have a uniform foreign policy, there's a fair amount of kind of variance and dissent from European capital to European capital about how much European countries are willing to do to shoulder the burden of opposing Putin in Ukraine. And I would like to think that if Europe could come to a common understanding among their own countries of responsibility, of primary responsibility, and of not being able to rely on the United States for maintaining European security against Moscow, then I think Europe could cut free of the concerns that it has about pissing off the president of the United States. So my estimate of the kind of near-term consequences to the international legal order are that it remains to be seen whether the rest of the international community speaks with a strong or relatively single voice to denounce what the United States has done. There has already been some reason to believe that, you know, some countries, you know, will stand up for what is right, others will not. But my belief is that if at least Europe could put up a united front telling the world this is not acceptable and recognize that if Europe can't depend on the United States for support against Moscow, then it's a substantial burden that Europe will have to face and bear on its own. That would be a great deal more of a benefit to the long-term international legal order than would be Europe's decision to kind of hold their criticism for fear of the United States. And that's what I hope will happen. But as I said, don't know.
Yeah, no predictions. I think ending on a note of a need for unity and resistance against the actions of this administration and the challenges that it poses is a good place to end this conversation. We've been talking about the invasion of Venezuela and the kidnapping of its leader, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Celia Flores. Our panel today has been Gabor Rona. He's professor of the practice at Cardozo Law School and the author of Is There a Way Out of the Non-International Armed Conflict Detention Dilemma? And State Responsibility to Protect, and Fulfill Human Rights Obligations in Cyberspace? And recently, Venezuelan boat attacks, utterly unprecedented and patently predictable. Carol Weiss, she's professor of political science and international relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Dragonomics, How Latin America is Maximizing or Missing Out on China's International Development Strategy, and Conceptualizing China-Latin America Relations in the 21st Century, The Boom, the Bust, and the Aftermath. That one she wrote with Victoria Chan-Chin. And Jeremy Suri, he's professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs and the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and his latest book is Civil Wars by Other Means, America's Long and Unfinished Fight for Democracy, and he also hosts the wonderful podcast This is Democracy. I want to thank you all for sharing your time and your expertise with us on such an important issue.
Thanks, Doug.
Yep. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Doug.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle or me at Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.